Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by GoToMeeting. I love GoToMeeting, and if you aren't using it, you need to try it. If you're not using a web conferencing tool or a service that you use is kind of, well, herky-jerky and a little clunky, use my first choice, which is GoToMeeting. Easy to use, secure, affordable. You really just get that wonderful opportunity to work in a virtualized state in no time at all. Easy to set up, easy to tell people how to use, and with voice over IP included, you can call in via the phone or your computer. Simply try GoToMeeting at gotomeeting.com/podcast. You get a 30-day free trial on that. And what's great about it is it's about a $49 value. You can do all the things that you want to do. Check it out. Run it through the tests. And I really encourage you to do so. Go to gotomeeting.com/podcast. Well, how are you? And welcome to this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. This is Andrew Horowitz. We're on episode number 165. Before we begin, I want to tell you something, that this episode is dedicated to all those people who have been touched and that are hurting and that are finding that their lives are changed forever because of what's happening in the Gulf region. You know, all those people that we really pour our hearts out to, and I want to let you know that we're thinking about you, and whether it's in Florida, the Panhandle area, whether it's in Louisiana, whether it's in Alabama, whether it's a family member that you know, whether it's anybody in that whole entire region, whether you work for a company that you're being laid off from, whatever it may be, our hearts go out to you. We're going to talk a little bit about the BP disaster, which is now an unprecedented level of oil that has flowed into any ocean around the world. The Exxon Valdez now looks like a little spot, a little stain, a little speckle. And right now, unfortunately, there's a lot more going on. We're finding a lot of things, and we'll talk about that in a second. We're going to talk about a lot of the things that I found really stupid that happened this week. And then we're going to bring in a guest, Harry Dent, of course, the author of many books, but his recent one, The Great Depression Ahead, How to Prosper in That. And I have a lot of questions I'm going to ask him about a lot of different things, but we're going to get to that in just a moment. In the meantime, I have just a lot of things that I'm going to try to also answer some of your questions. Lots to talk about, lots going on in the news these days. But let's start off with this. We know what's going on with the markets, but let's talk about the stupidity, okay? The absolute, unmitigated, ridiculous nature of what we see in the news. Let's talk about BP. Let's focus in on that. We started that discussion right off the bat. You know, now we're seeing that 40,000 barrels a day is what BP is going to try to siphon off. Well, congratulations, BP. What a great job you did at finding an unbelievable find of oil. I mean, 40,000 barrels a day, that's a gusher, that's a geyser. That is just incredible. But wait a second. We thought it was only 5,000, then 10,000, then 15,000, then 20,000. And denying that there are any underwater plumes that are massive. What is going on with the communication process? What's going on between our government, who obviously can't get their act straight when it comes to this, and what's going on with BP in that when it comes to giving us the straight scoop, they're just unable to do so. Tony Hayward wants to get his life back. Mr. Hayward, do us a favor. You're going to get your life back in your cushy blanket and really soft pillow one of these days, and you won't be bothered by this ridiculousness. But how many people's lives have been ruined? Now, the next stupid part of this is President Obama is talking about shutting down drilling altogether in shallow and deep water. Now, wait a second. They want also BP to pay for the damages of that. Now, how can BP pay for the damages of a regulation that the government's putting down? You want them to pay for the cleanup. You want them to pay for all the damages. You want them to pay for everything and all the layoffs and all the business. You're going to bankrupt this company, guys, and then they're not going to pay anything. They're not going to pay the dividend. They're not going to pay the claims. They're going to just go into a receivership, and then everybody's going to lose. So our government, in their infinite wisdom, as usual, has done what they can to create a bad situation and make it, quite frankly, a lot worse. they shouldn't be shutting down, and they shouldn't even be talking about shutting down the current drilling that's going on right now that has good safety records, maybe with other companies. They shouldn't be shutting down those because those people lose their jobs as well. The drilling that's being done in the deep water, okay, I'll give you that. That maybe you want to look at the safety protocols, you want to look at what the government regulatory bodies are doing to actually make sure that the oversight is taken care of. But you know what? It is just absolute stupidity to shut it all down right now. Where were you, government, when the regulations were written and when we were looking to find the safety protocols and to follow those before this all happened? Take some of the blame for that and just don't point fingers. And Mr. Obama, it would also be very wise of you not to point so many fingers in a way that pisses off England. England already stepped up and said that BP is one of the companies within their country, within, you know, they will step up to the plate to help out as well. So we need to kind of like tread a little bit lightly here to make sure that everybody's taken care of. You know, BP maybe now is the most hated company in the world, surpassing Goldman Sachs, which is kind of hard to believe, but it probably is. But shutting that all down just means more stupidity because you're going to create a higher unemployment rate. 20 to 40,000 jobs are estimated to be lost if you do so. And what's going to happen? The rigs are going to be taken somewhere possibly off the African coast and hired by hiring people that work in that area that they're required to do so. And the jobs will be moving over there and the companies will still be extracting oil, but not providing the employment and the income and the terribly needed capital, the earnings power to the people that work within the region. So now you're going to give them a double whammy. First, you're going to shut down the business. We get 35% of our shellfish and fish from that region within the United States. And then you're going to shut down their livelihood on top of that. I mean, this is just nuts. A little bit more thought needs to go into this plan, guys. Let's think about it. And BP, why don't you come clean? Why don't you tell us what's really going on? We don't need to find that there's 60,000 barrels that are leaking into the ocean each and every day. We need to know what's going on. Why aren't there more skimming boats going on? I mean, everybody wants to know about this, and I can probably go on for 3 hours about this, but I won't. I'm sure you're just as pissed off about this whole situation as I am. The second thing that I thought was just unbelievably stupid recently, maybe in the last few weeks, was this whole notion of the yuan, the Chinese currency appreciation. Now, this is great for us. You know, if their currency appreciates in value, because right now it's pegged to the dollar, and it's been so for about, I guess, almost 2 years now. Well, if they unpeg and they actually raise the value of their currency, maybe 10, 8, 10%, and then it rises even more to fair value, which is probably about 15% higher because of their surplus, of their account surplus, that's great because they'll be able to buy a lot more from Europe and a lot more from the U.S. But you know what? China's not stupid. They're just going to open up their floodgates to being less exports because their things are going to cost much more money. While their exports came in very hot, about 50% year over year, their inflation rate recently was about 3.1, higher, slightly higher than their peg rate, which is about the target rate, which is about 3%. But at the same time, with the global slowdown, with the euro dropping as much as it has lately, it's down about 20% against the euro, the Chinese yuan. And that is a problem because about 25% of all the exports from China go to Europe. So let's think about this for a second, gang. If you raise the value of the yuan, you're going to hurt the euro buying power that much more, create more of a problem for the exports from China, slowing down their economy. Why in the world would China want to do that? Well, Timothy Geithner and many of the various people who have written a letter that is supposed to be sent to the Chinese government saying that they are currency manipulators, not a good thing to do, stupid. We're in the stupid section here. If you do that, what's going to happen is that you're going to just aggravate them and they're going to do what's best for them anyway. Yes, they want the world to do well. There's no question about that. China derives a massive amount of their income from exporting. No question. But at the same time, you have to realize that while it is good for everybody else, it'll be great for commodities, the price of oil will go up, it will be good for our exports, it will be good for our economy. I just don't know if they're willing to do that transfer of payment, the transfer of their surplus, essentially, to our deficit. So I just don't see how that all works. And the senators and congressmen who are planning on sending a letter, and there's a variety of them. Lindsey Graham is one of them who is absolutely adamant about trying their best to say that there is a manipulation of the currency going on. And while there is, we've talked about this before, folks, you know what? We do the same thing. So get off it, guys. Move on. The third thing, which I think is stupid but yet brilliant, is this whole situation going on in Australia. Have you seen that the Australian government wanted to actually increase – what they did is they're increasing or proposing to increase the tax on their mining companies. Now, a lot of business in Australia is all about mining. It's all about the commodities, all about coal and gold and just a tremendous amount of things of copper and, I mean, BHP Billiton and Rio Tinto. These companies do an immense amount of work there, and that's how Australia skirted the actual recession at all through 2008-2009. Why they have to increase their interest rates, because right now their economy is at a point of not overheating, but getting to a point that employment is off the hook, frankly. Things are looking really good there. But Australia decided to put this incredible tax, basically biting the hand that feeds them. But here's what's really amazing, okay? The coal miners, Australian coal miners, got so upset about this, and the stocks dropped dramatically. But what'd they do? They're going to fight stupidity with basically bribery. So the Australian coal miners made a joint, about a $4 billion cash bid for a rail track network in the country's biggest coal state, aiming to prevent it from being sold on the stock market. Now, why would they do that? Because they're going to buy it from the state. But it was offered at about $3 billion, and that's what the estimated price was. So essentially, the group of 13 firms headed by BHP Billiton, Rio Tinto, and Zatra said that the bid for the network was conditional on the government dropping its plan to both sell the track network and the coal haulage business in an initial public offer. Now, the follow-up to this is that the Rudd government is preparing to back out of applying its new resource super profits tax on the gravel, lime, phosphate, and sand sector. So in a sense, this was a $1 billion overpriced bribe to the government to lessen the taxes and to actually bring down the overall pain that it was going to cost and cause. I mean, I haven't seen this written about anywhere. I haven't seen anybody put one and one together to make two on this, that there was this tax. They came in and to buy the private railway from the government, take it, make sure that they have control over it. Instead of it being a $3 billion IPO, they look to buy it for $4 billion. It's $1 billion over. And magically, within a week, they're talking about a little softening of the tax. Come on. Does anybody have any argument with that? That's a little bit more that meets the eye? These are the kind of things that are going on around the world over and over and over, between the rhetoric that we're seeing out of Europe, between the absolute stupidity out of our government, the inefficiency and effectiveness. These are the kind of things that get people nervous and why we can't get a stock market moving that is equivalent to possibly the future earnings that we may see in the next quarter, because there's just a tremendous amount of stupidity, raising taxes, raising rates. It's not time yet, folks. Don't keep on spending money stupidly. Don't keep on just opening the floodgates of money. Do it in a very, very smart manner. Keep rates low. Be careful on the quantitative easing, constrain budget, constrain government spending, and we could all be a lot happier. And the bottom line is you need to really reassert the fact that small businesses and the private sector is the motor, the engine that runs the growth of the world. Anything less than that is just simply stupidity. Government business is bad business. We're going to end on that rant right there. We're going to bring in Harry Dent. We're going to get it all lined up. Bring him in. Always a great pleasure to talk to my friend. He recently put out a quarterly newsletter and a monthly newsletter. I'm going to hit the key points that he's talking about because he has something very important to say when it comes to what's going to happen next in the market and the world. And I believe I talked to him the other day. He's going to have a free offer for you on one of his newsletters. Before we go, I want to mention to you that if you're looking for anybody to manage your money, why not, if you're listening to us and you like what we have to say, the kind of things that we have to say, how we do things, why not check out the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy? We have a 14-minute virtual tour. Just check it out. Go there right now because you'll forget. I know I always forget when I hear things like this. So go there right now. Push pause. Do whatever you got to do. TheDisciplinedInvestor.com. Go right there. And I want you to check out where it says virtual tour on the bottom or where the big blue box is, and that will take you right to the virtual tour to check it all out. When we get back, we're going to queue up Harry Dent. You're going to love what he has to say because I know you always have in the past. I have about 6 or 8 questions I want to ask him that I think you're going to be really interested in. Stick around. We're going to be right back on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Okay, we got it all set up. We are ready. We are ready to bring on Harry Dent, my good friend, actually fellow Floridian, and we'll find out a little bit more about what's going on because he's on the West Coast. Harry, how are you?
Good.
So there's a lot going on since the last time we talked. There's always a lot going on, but even so, you're over on the West Coast. What are you hearing? We'll get into the discussion I wanted, but what are you hearing about the whole BP disaster? Last we heard that they may be actually suspending their dividend, but that's a separate point. Anything happening on your beaches there?
Well, you know, no, I mean, just a little bit of stuff washing up, but I think everybody knows this is worse than it was told to be, so the impacts are probably going to be much worse and last for a longer period of time. So, I mean, yeah, it's possible BP could have to go into bankruptcy over this. There's no question. So it's just another one of the things that kind of fit into our geopolitical forecast and say, you know, things should get worse into this summer. You know, there's just cycles, and that's one of our cycles in geopolitical events.
Yeah, it is it's really amazing how these things just kind of seem to crop up all the time out of nowhere. There was that few months when we had earthquakes all the time. It was this unbelievable time period with all these earthquakes. Then we got the volcano thing and erupting. And then all of a sudden we get this, you know, sovereign thing in Dubai, and now we have this whole BP. It's weird. It really is a little bit spooky.
Yeah, I mean, what we found in history, I mean, we study obviously economics more, but I study science and other events and stuff, and things do tend to cluster together for some reason. There are cycles, and when certain things go wrong, other things tend to go wrong. And you know, our long-term cycles say that, you know, we're in for a difficult period for the next decade, and particularly you know, late this year into late 2012. That's our big danger zone, and particularly between, say, around mid-July and December of this year is when we see the greatest danger for a stock crash. And who knows what else would happen, you know, geopolitical events or volcanoes or earthquakes. That is something we can't predict, but we do notice that these things cluster together.
Well, we don't need anything else if we have a big stock crash. Let's leave it.
Yeah, exactly.
That's enough. Okay, so I want to talk to you about your latest forecast. You put out a monthly, you put out a quarterly, you put out special letters. As a matter of fact, we'll tell people more about this, and we're going to have a link on my site for this because, you know, I really think it's, and I really encourage my listeners to read Harry Dent's forecast. I'm going to tell you, and I'm going to tell you right to you, you know, to you, Harry, some of it's a little depressing, but that's okay if we need to know the information. Let's get that straight. You know, it's not all just wine and roses out there, especially these days. But we're going to have a link right to the site. We can get a special offer that Harry has discounted significantly the price of one of his letters and the forecast. So we're going to get to that. But in your latest forecast, you talked about, this is one from June just now, you had bullet points on the key forecasts and action steps for the months ahead. And I want to kind of go through those with you. The first one, and this is no order. This is no particular order that I'm having. It's in the order that you put down here, and I thought it was interesting. You said that a final strong rally in stocks to about 11,300 or so on the Dow Jones, plus a likely buy signal on about in the beginning of June. You said, and that was interesting because we track your, you know, we get your various buy signals, and we know that we follow some of the same things, the Lowry's, McClellan's, and all that. As a matter of fact, Tom McClellan was on the show not too long ago. Brilliant guy, love his work, and. You know, is this a, it looks to us, you know, as we see it, as a typical potential head and shoulders pattern where it's the last lookers are going to try to get in and there is a tremendous amount of buying pressure. A lot of things are oversold at this point. But is the thesis basically a technical thesis or is there more to that?
Well, you know, in the short term, the technicals are most important. I mean, there's no question the fundamentals say we're heading downward for many years to come. But in the short term, when this bear market rally peaks is really a technical matter. When does the smart money think this is over? When do you get everybody on the boat buying into this bear market rally? Because we've been very clear from the beginning, even when our book came out in late 2008 on these downward trends, we anticipated a strong bounce in the stock market and strong stimulus, and we anticipated levels in the 11,000 range on the Dow, but we didn't anticipate it would last this long. But I mean, the government stimulus has been very strong. So what our indicators are telling us is more likely that we actually see a slight new high on the Dow, that the April top, and they said the same thing in January, and we've had a lot of newsletters that we also consult and take, you know, that are more bearish in line with where we're at on deflationary trends, and everybody's been saying, oh, January was the top, April. Our technical indicators have been clear that we have not seen the type of divergences that say that the smart money is selling into this rally yet. So even in April, we said, you know, this doesn't look like a top. We're going to get a correction, and the correction went a little lower than we anticipated, a little longer, but we gave buy signals here recently, and we think we're going to see one more rally to new highs, again, 11,300, maybe even, you know, 11,600 or so, and then we're going to see a bigger crash. Then we're going to see a peak in this bear market rally. And we're going to be looking in our newsletter for some divergences that we haven't seen yet that look more likely to occur. So, I mean, we're going to have to wait for that. But everything I see says we're in the ninth inning of this bear market rally.
So what if, though, let me throw this into your prediction of, and again, mostly it's technically said here, but then the fundamentals don't support things moving forward. I do see that earnings will be probably okay next quarter, which is only in a couple of weeks, you know. But let me ask you this. What if, and I think some of your discussion is predicated on the stimulus, what if out of nowhere, magically, we come up with a few hundred million more in stimulus, a billion, not, did I say million? What does million get you anyway?
Billion.
Yeah. What if that happens? Does that throw a little bit more of juice into this possibly for a little bit longer that will then, of course, potentially roll over again according to your thesis? Or has that, you know, been baked in already?
Well, no, that's not. I mean, that's where the short term is important, to look at these technical indicators and what the government does. Because in our June issue, we said, hey, scenario number one, our most likely scenario, is a slight new high. But scenario two is that, yes, Europe stepped up quicker than most people thought, and maybe the U.S. government sees this slowdown increasing, which our indicators are saying it is. We are heading towards a double dip very rapidly, and they come up with a strong enough stimulus plan to put this out a little farther in the future. In that case, we would have a smaller correction, 20-30% in July, August, September or so, and then we may see this rally extend. But I tell you, our overall cycles and our overall indicators more strongly suggest, we give it 80% odds that we're going to see a more substantial crash and a top to this bear market rally somewhere between late June and late July, probably mid-July.
Mid-July, so that's the top. Okay, and I think you also would admit, because you've talked about this a lot of times, or maybe you won't, oftentimes these kind of moves last a little longer than is anticipated.
Yeah.
You know, so that mid-July, that's a flexible time period. I know that because, you know, it seems that the extension of something, just like this correction right now, it's extending. But, you know, you have a lot of non-believers, hanger-oners, you know, just there may be other things. It can't be ever exactly right, of course, obviously.
Right, and that's the other thing. Like, when we look at our long-term indicators on demographic spending and technology, S-curve trends and things like that, these things are pretty set in stone, you know, and pretty much do what they say with some minor variations. But in the short term, you're right. I mean, things around the world can happen, news events. I mean, a BP oil spill, some bank going down somewhere in Spain or something. I mean, so yes, these things can extend more. And particularly, we've been in a bubble boom since the mid-90s, and everything's exaggerated. I mean, we tell people we can give you the direction of the markets, but the magnitude and the exact timing is harder to call because we're in bubbles, and in bubbles, people kind of go crazy. I mean, it's hard to believe, with all the indicators we show in our newsletter that say home prices are not coming back despite the recovery, defaults are going straight up like there was no recovery, mortgages are going to reset. The worst mortgages are going to reset this fall. I mean, when Ben Bernanke got on the other day and said, oh, we don't see any problem with a double dip and we're good through the next year, I'm like, you must be crazy. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're looking at indicators that say the only reason the economy is recovering is government stimulus, and businesses are building inventories thinking this must be a recovery because the government's stimulating. But consumer trends and all the things we look at are going the other way.
Do you think that companies are so stupid to not really understand the dynamics of all this and just to be biting into the rhetoric and the information passed on by the government? I just can't imagine a company would be that stupid.
No, they're not stupid. They're doing the same thing they've done, which I would include in that Warren Buffett and a lot of smart investors. Every time we've had a correction or a recession in the last 20, 30 years, the government has stimulated, and the baby boomers have been there ready to spend and borrow more to make use of that. Mm-hmm. What we're saying is something really changed here in 2008, something we were predicting for 20 years back, that the baby boomers would switch from spenders to savers, and you would get, you know, strong debt levels that would now have to deleverage. Once those two things start to happen, as Japan learned in the 1990s, you can stimulate. The economy never comes back to where it is, and you keep having to write off bank loans. So the government's hoping that they can stimulate the economy back to where it was in 2007. Home prices will come back, and banks won't have to write all these loans. And businesses, which they've learned, they're not stupid. They're thinking, yeah, every time we've had a downturn and the government has stepped in and stimulated, we've gone back to new highs. So we need to be assuming we're going back higher. And businesses are going to be wrong about this. The government's going to be wrong. Leading indicators are going to be dead wrong about this. We've got a whole set of indicators in our newsletter that are saying, no, things are moving down. M3, the broadest money supply, has turned negative this year, which says deflation when everybody's worried about inflation. The trends are the opposite of what they look, because businesses, governments, and leading indicators do not know how to measure and anticipate a deflation crisis when debt starts to deleverage and when a generation starts to shift from spenders to savers. They don't know how to measure that. We haven't had that for decades, and that's the problem, the wrong indicators.
You know, I've been reading, you know, I read a lot, as you do, probably too much, unfortunately, as you do probably as well. But I noticed that there has been, in some of the articles that I've been reading lately, peppered throughout the article is this concept of, you know, the aging population countries. And I was thinking of you because I think you coined a lot of that, or really, you know, popularized a lot of that back in many of your books and in many of your conversations. And I always use that whole demographic discussion as well. The aging populations are clearly the ones that are having the most problems. I think there's no question about that. Is there a...
Japan and Southern Europe have the biggest debt problems because they have aging populations and declining tax revenues and rising benefits.
Right. And that's
an easy forecast.
Right, exactly. Is there any chance that if the... I mean, I think the answer is pretty easy, but, you know, is there any light at the end of the tunnel for the countries as in... China and some of the Asian countries, India, Brazil, some in South America. Are there any of those countries that will be able to do well through all this, or is this just going to be this big ripple effect, in your opinion?
Well, it'll be a big ripple effect because these emerging countries, almost all of them, particularly China and Brazil and countries like that, have a lot of their GDP geared towards export industries, geared towards the developed countries and other growing emerging countries.
Right.
And when our growth slows down, their exports slow down, and they will go down. But no, you're right. The demographics of the emerging world is where the action is going to be in the future. We're telling investors, once we see this crash that we're anticipating later this year and probably again into 2012, once that bottoms, the real you're going to have to be looking at countries like India, and even China's not going to be as attractive. They are aging, but India, Southeast Asia, the Middle East, and Latin America are going to be the growth engines of the world when the Western world continues to age. You cannot. Even Ben Bernanke alluded to this. We have an aging society, mm-hmm. but he doesn't add up the numbers and say, well, guess what? Things can never get back to normal on home prices and economic growth. Therefore, our stimulus is not going to work like in Japan. How can they not add up these numbers? The Western world is going to go sideways for decades while the emerging world steals most of the growth.
Right.
And India would be our single pick for the best large country to invest in.
I agree, but the problem is, of course, as a matter of fact, the thing that India announced last week where they're going to start to distribute more money to the common worker. They're going to take the money that they've made over time in the industry, et cetera, and from their various surplus, and they're going to take that and distribute it. I thought it was a brilliant move. It's very much what Australia is looking to do, although Australia was stupid, and I just talked about this earlier in this episode, that they were stupid to try to bite the hand that feeds them by putting that massive tax on the miners. And but yet at the same time, India is looking to do a redistribution of the assets, not distribution like we're doing here from the wealthy to the poor, to the not wealthy. They're looking to actually help out, and not even in a socialized manner, but just to distribute some of the wealth from the government, from the surplus, if you will, from the coffers to the individual. I thought that was a brilliant plan, or at least a brilliant concept.
Yeah, and they need that there. I mean, I would say to India, I would take that surplus and I would invest it in infrastructure, because I've been to India twice in the last 3 years. And, you know, you've got people that are creative and hardworking and deal with chaos, including driving in a way we never could here in the United States, but they just have no infrastructure. So there's so poor electricity and water distribution and all these things that these people are fighting an uphill battle. If they just had better infrastructures, they would be doing much better. So, and I think they're going to get that. I think the Indian government is waking up to that. And they're going to start to track the type of investment China has. And we in our, I think it was our May issue, we talked about China being in the biggest bubble ever. I mean, it's unbelievable. They're building cities for a million people here and there with nobody in them. They've got 30-40% excess industrial capacity. They're just building stuff to keep their economy going. And they're going to see a big burst. So I'd much rather look at India than China. And China is aging faster than the United States as we go forward.
You know, China, one of the things that they're really concerned about is the inflation rate there. This week they came out with a number that was 3.1. That's about 0.1 above their target rate. I don't personally understand what the big deal is about that. In other words, a 3% inflation rate is not inflationary. You follow what I'm saying?
You're right. 3% inflation is not bad. And in India, when I was there recently, it was 18% in food prices and I think 12% in normal. That's something to be concerned about. Yeah. In China, the problem is they have a real estate bubble that's just as out of control as ours, and they're going to have to clamp it down, and it's going to cause a lot of problems. Not as big as ours, because not as many people own real estate. But believe me, I mean, we've been looking at China recently, and what they're doing is not sustainable, especially if Europe starts to go into double dip and then the United States follows them. And all of our indicators say, yes, this is going to happen, and sooner rather than later.
So in this episode, right before we started, I had a little ranting session. I talked about three stupid things. I talked about, one, the BP situation and the things that are going on with the government and all that. I talked about, two, the Australian mining tax and how basically they were the Australians may be getting bribed out of that by a privatization buy of the railroad. But the third point that I pointed to being stupid was this whole discussion about the appreciation or the resetting of the peg for the yuan, for the Chinese yuan. I do not understand why China would do that. Can you educate me? It's not. I just can't get through. I understand the dynamics of it. I don't understand why China, at this stage of where they are, would want to do something like that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they're in a negotiation where they're getting pressured to, but, you know, they're not going to want to do that. And again, their economy, 35% of their economy and up to a much higher percentage recently has been exports. And that we even have figures, I think, from our main newsletter that says that China, 90% of their growth up to recently was just capital investment from government and foreign sources. It wasn't about real consumer spending and business investment. So they need these exports to keep going. And the only, you know, they're not going to give on this if they don't have to. And the more important point is, if the United States and Europe do go back down again, which we think is darn near certain, that that export economy is going to slow down and China is going to have that bubble on their part unravel on them. It won't be as much a real estate bubble. That'll be a minor factor. It'll just be all this excess capacity and infrastructures and industrial capacity that is now, and that's useless.
Right.
And they're going to have to write off a lot of loans, and a lot of businesses are going to go under.
And the thing is that the euro has already, and you know, not the dollar because it's pegged to it, but the euro has dropped about 20% against the against the yuan already. So it's already going to cause them problems because about 25%
exactly.
of it.
Exactly.
It's just
that's right. How could they afford to devalue against the U.S. dollar? I mean, raise it against the U.S. dollar on top of that. They can't afford that. So again, only political pressure may push it a little bit, but they're going to say, yeah, maybe they don't want to do this.
Yeah, I'd rather them do something else.
And that's not the solution anyway. The solution is we have a credit bubble around the world, $102 trillion in debt in the United States alone, and we have to deflate this bubble, and it's going to be painful for a few years, but you can't try to inflate your way out of this. You only increase the debt and the problem. The government stimulus is going to fail sooner or later. We think sooner in the next few months it's going to start to fail, and you're going to see government deficits like you've never seen. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you got to get ahead of this. We think the market's got one more rally, and then you got to get out of the stock market and don't run to bonds at first. Wait until interest rates spike a little later down the road, and then bonds will be great. But there's a lot of great opportunities coming. But boy, you can't be thinking like the people that think the government has rescued this, and you can't be thinking like the people like Peter Schiff who say inflation is going to come out of this. There's only one resolution to a debt crisis. That is deflation.
Yeah, Peter Schiff, you know, it's interesting because he's been right about a few things. For example,
he
was right about gold, and I'll give him that. He was dead wrong. I mean, absolutely dead wrong on the dollar, and he should have probably pushed his idea over to Europe. He was dead wrong about China in 2008, and then
foreign markets, exactly.
Terrible.
Yeah.
So the gold thing is really his walking stick with that. We're talking with Harry Dent.
Even gold, he's going to be wrong, and then gold is going to go down.
Wait, hold on to that.
Hold on
to that.
Gold is going to go down the next 2 years.
Hold on to that. We're going to talk about that in a second. We're talking to Harry Dent, the gentleman who wrote one of my favorite books back in when was the first book you wrote? What was the first book? What year was that?
1992, The Great Boom Ahead.
Great Boom Ahead. One of my favorite books. It's hard to read with all the dog-earing and all the underlines and all that, and it's crinkled. But he also has, if you want to attend this, they have demographic schools. He's going to be in November 10th to 11th, 2010, in Tampa, Florida. And you can get more information about that by going to hsdent.com. And also, he has a special offer for our listeners. That's over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. In the show notes, we'll have a link that you could check out to find out about this. The HS Dent forecast comes out monthly. He has a quarterly. He has the stock signals and all sorts of great things. These guys write between himself and Rodney and all the other guys over there do a great job. Let's talk about gold. So gold has been driving up, and I think for good reason, not the reason that most people would think, which was inflation, this whole inflation idea and all that. Everybody's all, you know, with gold, inflation protection. That was, I think, the initial idea when we saw all this money being printed and the quantitative easing. I think what ended up happening was the fear trade on a currency level from a sovereign default is really what took over, right?
Yes. That's what's happening. But ultimately, when things deflate, the deflation will be an even stronger source. And a lot of people don't realize what we tell people in our newsletter. And it's really hard to get this logic. But when you talk about debasing the U.S. dollar or currencies like in Europe, we debased our currencies in the boom because we allowed such unprecedented lending and borrowing and creation of credit. In this downturn, we're going to destroy a lot of that credit, restructure a lot of debt, and that's going to actually reduce the number of dollars in the world and euros and stuff, but dollars even more, and that makes the currencies actually more valuable. The U.S. dollar has been going down 60% since 1985. It's already been debased.
Right.
And we've been telling people, we've got people to buy the dollar starting in the first week of January and said, look, it's going up. Because we were saying, why are people fleeing to the euro when they've got worse demographics in the United States and huge debt problems over there, and now the euro's getting rallied? It's not like any of the currencies are good, but the lesser of the evils is going to be the U.S. dollar. And when you get into a deflationary downturn, gold is still the biggest factor driving gold is still demand for countries like India and China that are growing. And when they start slowing down with us, I think gold is going to go down. Gold also, we measure how bullish people get on things. We've seen 97% readings three times and recently 98% bullish on gold. That says we are near a top. And gold is not going much higher. It may spike here and there. We warn people that, but I would not be betting on gold at this point. I'd rather buy the U.S. dollar, and I'd much rather short U.S. stocks. That's the best play coming up.
You know, in fact, on page, I don't know if it's page numbered here, page 14 of your recent discussion. You have the sentiment for gold, crude oil, and all that. And the gold sentiment did spike, although it is coming down now. And in fact, if you look at the technicals on gold, just the technicals for a moment, it definitely had a double top there. And it looks like we're seeing a lot of divergence in down. We sold our gold just last week or so. I was very pleased about that, that it happened to work out. The timing was good. We've actually bought and sold it a few times. Right now, for the moment, we're staying away from it. We're actually looking at shorting the gold miners. Gold going down, gold miners are really going to be apt to have some trouble if there's any kind of a, you know, even when the market was up 3% the other day, the gold miners were up 0.5% maybe. So I think that the gold miners could have a lot of trouble, because if gold, you know, starts to go down in value, they're going to even get more of a whipsaw on the way down.
Yeah, you're going to have two trends there. Stocks going down ultimately in a few months, probably hard, and gold probably maybe spiking a little at first, but then following. So you get a double play there on gold going down and stocks, because we're betting on the U.S. dollar up and gold and stocks and most commodities down. Oil is the one thing I would consider buying here. It's kind of hard to, because the ETFs are not as good because of the contango or the futures they have there, but I think oil is likely to spike up towards $100 sometime in July, August, September, because our geopolitical cycles suggest that, you know, we're going to have some type of crisis in the Middle East and elsewhere, and that's probably going to benefit oil more than gold.
I have a solution for you, at least what we're thinking. We like some of the oil companies. Now, I know they're stocks. Bear with me for a second, though, okay? Just like what happened with gold when gold was going up, that the stocks of the gold miners and the gold-related companies do better. We like the onshore, in other words, not offshore. We like the onshore drillers and exploratory companies, and the ones that have a mixture of oil and natural gas. There's a couple of them out there. There's a lot of them out there. We like, it used to be called St. Mary's. Now it's called SM Energy and Contro Resources. And that genre could do very well if oil spikes up.
Right, and that's right, because they're focused in that area, and they're not in general, you know, economic gasoline and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
So I agree. The only problem is once the stock market starts going down, it tends to take everything with it to some degree.
I'm with you. In a stock market correction, 3/4 of the stocks go down no matter how good it is. Two more points real quick. So we talked about gold. Sell real estate in the next few months before the next crisis sets in. So the thought that real estate prices have been stabilizing at best, by the way, depending on where you are, I think they just, in my neck of the woods, and I think which is not too far from your neck of the woods, they went down again. But do you think that housing prices will continue down? Now, let me throw this out at you. I think people are very surprised at the fact that the foreclosures are actually increasing. One of the reasons is that the banks have finally gotten to a point that they said, you know what, we're not holding back on this anymore. We saw a report from Bank of America, directly from Bank of America, that said that they would be showing from about 8,000 foreclosures per month that they were putting on the market. They're going to ramp it up to about 40,000 per month from about 2 months ago, April, till about the end of the year. So there is no surprise to me that foreclosures are hitting highs here. I don't think it's a surprise to you either. I think the result of that is probably what you're talking about, with all this excess amount of property on the market that will be looked to be sold at fire sale prices that could do nothing but to pressure the price of housing. Is that thesis?
Exactly. We've been saying for many, many months, we have this recovery, but you look at home prices, not home sales. Home prices have barely bounced, despite this strong bounce in retail sales and GDP and stuff from all the stimulus. And it's because you have this endless chain of defaults and foreclosures. And you're right, the banks at first held back the foreclosures because they didn't want to pour more oil on the fire. And now they're going to say, well, wait a minute. Sooner or later they're going to say, well, wait a minute, things aren't getting that much better. We got to get rid of these things. So, yes, we see home prices going down substantially again between 2011 and 2012. And I would not look at buying homes or real estate or commercial in most areas until at least late 2012, early 2013. But the most important point is, if home prices go down again, it's going to absolutely kill the banking system that was already melting down in 2008. So that's why we've said there's no way out of this. Home prices are not going to come back. There aren't buyers for them. There's all these defaults. Baby boomers are moving from spenders to savers, something we've been saying for 20 years, and we got $102 trillion in debt, not just the 12 to 13 federal debt people hear about. the debt is so far bigger than anything we've seen. There's no way the government can stop this deleveraging any more than Japan did in the 1990s. So you got to prepare for the downside here, which if you do, can be great because you not only make money in your investments, but everything you want to buy in the future, from yachts to cars to real estate to stocks and companies, goes down in value. It's a sale.
So let me ask you, if I was to say, Harry, I'm with you, but do me a favor. Let's be devil's advocate to your own thesis just for a second. However positive you are about this, what can either, let's say, postpone or soften the situation in your opinion? Except for nothing.
Again, the U.S. acts quickly here like Europe and sees this kind of slowing. Now, I don't think that's going to happen because Ben Bernanke just came out and said, our reading is no problem through the end of next year.
Wait, Harry.
Recovery's going to be slow.
Ben Bernanke speaks and he talks and words come out. That is, may not be really what's reality behind the scenes. He's not going to come out and say, hey, things look like crap. We're really worried about
things. Pretty hard to say no problem for the next year and a half and then say, oh, we got to have an emergency stimulus program that is huge. Because if they do anything that's not huge, they're not going to win this battle. Yeah. And even if they do, it's just going to put it off another year. That's the way we look at it. They already put it off a little more than a year with this massive stimulus. You cannot beat this tidal wave of debt and baby boom slowing. There's no way you can do it. Japan has proved this beyond a shadow of a doubt. So, yes, if they react strongly near term, we may get when things start to slow down in July, August. We think one of the key things is that second quarter GDP is going to come out very disappointing, more like 1% or something. And that's not going to be good for the stock market with all this built-up recovery sort of stuff. So if the government reacts to that quickly and strongly, then you may just get a minor crash there, and then they may put this off for another year, and then we get the bigger crash when our next cycle hits from late 2011, 2012. But again, we already have that as a scenario too. We always have that in our newsletters and our forecasts. There's always a scenario two and more sometimes. But the preponderance of our cycles and indicators say, no, this thing's going to come apart July, August, September, October.
All right, well, we'll have to see what happens with that. And I'm waiting for an invitation to speak at one of your demographic events. Maybe one of, you know, folks, if you want me to be there, maybe you should write in and say, hey, why isn't Horowitz speaking over at the Dent? Not too far. What are we, a few hours? We can go to Burns for dinner? I mean, this would be fun. You like Burns? No, not so much, huh?
Yeah, Burns is good. More for atmosphere than food.
Oh, no question about that. But you could take me in one of your fancy car you have and all that. I love that. Anyway, great guy, great friend, Harry Dent. Always, you know, it may not be the things that you say that we want to hear. Let's be honest. You know that. But we're not going to shoot the messenger because I think the messenger in this one, just like Paul Revere, had to tell the story before things got bad.
Andrew, you know, we've been bullish for 20 years. We are not bearish. We're not Rubinis who are always bearish, and then you're finally right, and a pig, you know, stumbles on an acorn. We have been bullish more than anybody for 20 years, and now we're saying, and we said it from the beginning, this boom will end at a point, and the greater the boom, the greater the bust.
I hear you. You know, the date range, I guess the thing is what we're talking about is going to be the question. We do see a lot of problems as well. The idea is to ride as much of it as you can get off when the going's good. That's the whole trick to all this. And, you know, the fact of the matter is, if you don't play, you know, I talked about this a few weeks. If you're not in the game, you can't play. If you're in the game, you can get nicked, you can get hurt, but at least you can get some opportunity either side of the direction. I think that's the thing we try to bring to the folks that are listening. Harry Dent, so much thank you again. Check out the HS Dent, the forecast. The special offer will be on our site, hsdent.com. Also coming up is the Demographic School in November in Tampa, November 10th to 11th. You can find out more information about that at hsdent.com. We'll have all this information, where to get his book, all that good stuff, because this is just brilliant reading, brilliant information right on our website in the show notes as well. Harry, nice talking to you, my friend. We'll talk soon.
Okay, enjoyed it, Andrew.
All right, bye-bye. Well, Harry Dent, great guy, and like I said, don't shoot the messenger. I mean, he's coming with some of his opinion. A lot of other people out there thinking a lot of positive thoughts. We saw some people from BlackRock and a variety of other the big names, LPL, coming out with some very bullish calls recently, that this is the time to buy into the markets. We've seen some other players out there, such as Dennis Gartman, saying that he thinks things are going to get a lot worse. But nonetheless, well, there's a lot of room for opinions out there in the world, and that's why we bring it to you here. I also wanted to answer, I got just a pile of questions that are adding up here, and I wanted to get to some of those. By the way, thank you for, you know who you are, sent me that sampler of the coffee from Starbucks, the Vaya instant coffee. We're going to try that out next week and do a little taste test with some of the folks in the office. And I think that that was very nice of you, and we'll see if I actually enjoy that, because we enjoy our coffee with fresh grinds a little bit. I had a question I just want to answer real quickie here. This is a question from Sean Stanford. And he said, I've been listening to your podcast for a while now, and you've talked a lot about investing in BRIC, B-R-I-C, countries at various points, but I don't think I've ever heard any more information about how to do so. So what are the ticker symbols or funds that one should be looking at in order to invest in the BRIC countries, and what are good resources for information on these? The BRIC countries, the traditional BRIC countries, B-R-I-C, is B for Brazil, R for Russia, I for India, C for China. Now, in Brazil, you can look at things like the EWZ, the iShares EWZ ETF. You can look at for the Russia RSX is a good reference ETF for that region as well. There's a lot of sometimes different ETFs you can use for the same purpose as, for example, a Brazilian small cap. But we'll stick to the core names right now. In India, there's a few of them as an iShares, but we like the one that has the symbol EPI, which is the India Earnings Fund. And for China, there's a couple of choices you have here. You can look at the China area, because China is China, of course, and then there's Hong Kong. Hong Kong is FXI. We like that from the developed side a little bit more. And then you have CAF, which is the China fund that tracks the Shanghai market. And that obviously realize that you can have currency fluctuations in there. But if, in fact, we are in a situation where the dollar may start, you know, not its amazing ride up and start slowing down, you'll get some good ride on those as well. So again, the BRIC countries are BRIC, Brazil, Russia, India, and China. For a long time, we didn't want to use Russia. I think the reason was clear that when they closed down their markets because markets weren't operating correctly, we couldn't really trust them. But Russia seems to be getting their act together. They issued their first bonds recently, and that was just a great testament to the fact that the world does do a lot more, has a lot more trust for Russia right now. And where do you find that information? I mean, you have to look at ETF lists, your Yahoo Finance, of course, Google Finance, MSN. I like FinViz, FinViz.com. They have some great information. ETF Universe, ETF Trends, lots of places that you can take a look at and find information about that. One of the things you may want to do is go to a screener like they have on FinViz and see about screening for certain country exposure or certain names. So that will give you an idea of where to look. There's a lot of ETFs. One of the things I do recommend is that you find an ETF that has trading over about 50,000 shares per day. Anything less than that may give you a liquidity problem. We've seen that happen recently in the recent flash crash where liquidity was dried up overall and it really didn't help out the situation. The other thing that I'll mention here is that, and I'm going to answer this question in a roundabout way. This question comes from Marty. I don't know if I have a last name here. But Marty says, Andrew, maybe on some of your next podcast, you could do a short explanation of what exactly Fibonacci retracements are and how they were developed so all your listeners or just me can understand why they are important. Marty, what we're going to do is we're going to have that answered on one of the upcoming Winning Investor podcasts. That's the podcast. This week we talked about, GARP investing, growth at a reasonable price. The week before that, we talked about growth investing. The week before that, we talked about value investing. We talked about all sorts of things in a five-minute quickie. Give you the basic, primer, whatever you pronounce that word. I think that we go back and forth on that, don't you? But we'll talk to the grammar girl, which way is to actually actually say that word. But I think that, when we look at the basic fundamentals and the building blocks of investing, that's what we talk about that most. If you want to ask me a question, we have lots more to go through that we will head to the next few weeks. Just send me an email at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and I'll answer any questions that you have. We're going to wrap it up here. Lots to talk about coming up. Kate Stalter from Investors Business Daily is coming up. We have actually Charles Kirk next week lined up from the Kirk Report. Many of you know who he is. We've been talking for about a year and a half trying to get him on the show. We have also looking to bring on Tim Seymour from Fast Money. I talked to John Najarian this morning about a variety of things. He's always a great guest. And we talked to him about, giving us some time in the future to bring him on again. And he was very appreciative of the time he spent. I hope you enjoyed that podcast a couple of weeks back. And then we're also going to bring back some of our old favorites. We're going to bring back Das one of these days. We're going to bring back, the trader, which is Fausto Puglisi this summer. And we have a couple more surprises that we're working on as well. Trying to get Robert Reich. They promised they'll give us a date soon. But with all things that are going on right now, it seems that they're pretty busy. But we'll get a date shortly with him as well. And then we'll bring on some new names as well, talking about some of the grain markets. We're going to talk about the emerging markets in much greater detail in a couple of episodes on the way. In the meantime, once I told you again, if you're nervous about what to do, not really understanding what to do, should I short, should I go long? If it's kind of been one of those times you're just beating yourself up, well, give us a shot. Check out the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy. Come to the site. Take that free 14-minute tour. It's fun. It's painless. It's good for you. And we'll be sure to get you everything you need to know about how to invest and what to do. It's $50,000 minimum. And also you get a access to our client-only blog site where we talk about everything that we do each and every week to educate you, help you with transparency, and understand what's happening. So with that, we're going to say adieu. Again, this show is going out to all those folks that are affected, which is really all of us in a way, by the BP disaster. I want to thank you for listening. Thank you for your support. Make sure, if you can, go over to iTunes and leave a quick review. Not just a rating, but a review. I'd really appreciate it. And tell a couple of friends about it. That's how we get this thing going. This is Andrew Horowitz for Disciplined Investor Podcast number 165. Saying goodbye. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.